ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे
नमः. The intelligence is like the adults in the room, and the mind has a whimsical nature. It can shift at any time and decide to do something that's not savory, maybe even destructive. So deliberation in a group like this is part of the bhakti process. Discussion, especially based on instruction, knowledge that comes from a higher source, is one of the ways in which the intelligence gets fortified. And, of course, that saves a lot of problems. And as I was saying, there's an affliction, which is called avidya. Vidya means knowledge, or being clear on what to do, so that one doesn't become entangled, or implicate oneself further in the, what are called the modes of material nature, which are kind of like ropes to tie us up. And if you say avidya, when you put akar and a in front of a word in Sanskrit, often reverses the meaning. So avidya means like, I don't know what's going on. And that's dangerous. I mean, if I blindfold myself and drive home on the 101, there's going to be carnage. So simply without knowledge, without light, without a clear idea of how to maneuver through the world, then I can run into difficulties. And of course, the Vedas simplify things and say that the source of all difficulties is avidya. It's not knowing what you're doing. So deliberate, it says, and use guidance from sources that are that you accept as spiritually viable. And if you do that, decide on that, then you'll be guided in a proper way. So all that was just to say that I'm happy to be here. And recently I found in various settings that people, serious practitioners like yourselves, have questions, maybe. And if you do, it's an interesting kind of forum just to bring up questions of whatever kind. And the best of them are those that I'm trying to probe and see how I can increase my spiritual practice, things like that. And it opens up a kind of a deeper, sometimes wider discussion. So, do any of you have a question you'd like to ask? Yeah, what is your name?
Kevin,
nice to see you again.
So my question is, when you find yourself in moments where, you know, you're not prepared and you said,
yeah, there's a mic in the bag, there's a receiver in my hand. Actually, just bring me that blue bag open, make it out. 30 seconds left. Well, my experience started with chanting when I was in my teens, and I was drawn to spiritual life, naturally, I think, because from the time I was very young, I was a little bit concerned, I would say a lot concerned, about the idea that I had to die. I don't know if that's normal for kids, but I kept asking that question again and again, why do I have to die? And when I got into high school, by my junior year, I kind of concluded that unless I answered that question, the rest of it was not that important to me. Because it seemed to me a waste of time to learn trigonometry and physiology, if I was just going to die anyway. That was a bigger question for me. And then I searched various, searched out various teachers and writings and traditions and so forth. And chanting was very prevalent in a lot of them that I studied. I was kind of eclectic at first. Then when I came in touch with my teacher and received, a lot of detailed information about the power of mantra, where it comes from. It's a supreme combination of syllables. It's a formula, a spiritual formula. And understanding the different kinds of energies that emanate from the from our original divine source and how we can be in touch with those energies. It all made sense to me. So then I gained some conviction for chanting the mantra, and it didn't seem foreign to me at all when he introduced that idea to me about chanting the Maha Mantra, which is the one that he specifically recommended. So when I started chanting, it's before I had come and joined my teacher full time and moved into the ashram and things like that. So when I came in, it just seemed like a continuation of that. And how's it been over the years? It's been a very centering activity. I can say in the different phases of my life, because I have the chanting, it brings me back to the center and into balance. Because I've noticed that it's really easy for the mind to go off on tangents, even by small degrees, and then you can end up in another universe. Even between the time I go to bed at night and when I wake up in the morning, I'm not the same person. The mind is talked about a lot in the Vedic scriptures about how even treacherous it is, and not to trust it and to be very careful, to train it. And actually in one section it's described how it's like if you catch a wild animal and bring him home and tame him, you know, you hear about this all the time. Yeah, he's harmless, you know. You leave the cage open, and the next day everyone's dead. You know, they change the wild animal changes its mind sometimes. It has that little strain in it. So the mind can do that too. So I found it important in my life, and I've gone through various phases in my life, obviously growing up in Krishna consciousness. And having the chanting to always center me has been a really important part of my life in all aspects, whatever they may have been, academic achievements, staying balanced in living a life, you know, with material possessions and things like that. And of course, staying on the spiritual path. It always brings me back to that every time I chant. So I take time every morning, especially, to enter into the Maha Mantra. Some of the ways that I do that is when I start the chanting, I focus my mind on a couple of things. One is that I'm actually helpless. Now, oftentimes in my normal course of my life, I might think that I'm doing everything and I'm self-determining. But in moments of clarity, even when I consider it carefully, I see that actually I really have not much to say, for instance, with how long I'm going to live. I already told you I was obsessed with this. So. But as an example, just to give you like an example of what I mean by a moment of clarity, one day I was taking a nap and I woke up and I was still lying there, but I became aware of my heart beating. And then it kind of astounded me because I realized it's been beating a long time and I never even noticed it. So I had a conversation. I said, "With your heart, thank you very much for all the work you've been doing for me all these years. I've never really thanked you." And my heart spoke back. My heart said, "Yeah, you're welcome. But I'm just doing my job. And to be really honest, I can't guarantee how long I'm going to do my job because it's not up to me." There's a higher voice that comes in and says, "Okay, stop now." And this was, you know that area of lucidity, that kind of thin space between when you're sleeping and then you just wake up? It's kind of in that space that I'm having this mental conversation. So really then when I put my feet back on the floor, I had a very different perspective of the world that I can't take it for granted. And so I try to get into that space before I chant and to realize that everything's a gift. I should be grateful for every breath I have, for every beat of the heart, and that I really don't have control over it. And when I come to that mindset, then when I start to chant, chanting has a lot more focus for me, as I'm saying it in a way that I'm calling for help. Please help me. And please guide me. Please direct me. And that kind of chanting, I find, comes more from the heart. Now, when I'm able to do that successfully, even, you know, 16 rounds can take maybe an hour and 40 minutes for me. I want 45. But if I can have, within that time period, even a short period of clarity, when I'm actually chanting with attention and feeling, I feel fulfilled. And this came to me recently. You know the old admonition, don't shop when you're hungry? Have you ever done it accidentally?
Yes.
Anyone? Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Eat it
all up. How to work out for you? So it's happened to me a few times. I go, and it's like, I'm starving, and then I think, I don't shop much anyway, but it just, you know, it was happenstance, so I happened to be in there shopping, and I remember, oh, you're hungry, no wonder you want to buy everything in the whole store. You've never eaten that before, why would you buy it now? So I'm starving. And so in a similar way, I considered, you know, I shouldn't go out into the world. I shouldn't entertain various kinds of relationships, opportunities, without having a sense of fulfillment first. When I'm centered, when I feel my own integrity through my own practice of sitting and being truthful with myself, am I focused or not focused? Am I actually chanting with sincerity? And did I connect? Did I connect? Even if it's for a fraction of a second I connected, then I feel centered, I feel full enough to go out into the world. Otherwise, it's like a hungry man going out into a store. And everything I see, I can either want it, or I can be repulsed by it, or I can make snap decisions that won't help me, and so forth. So it's been really important to me, still answering your question with a long, drawn-out answer. It's been really important to me throughout my life to take time to chant the mantra. Another question? You ask good questions, all of you. Yes?
Oh, be careful, please.
So, while chanting, the focus is the hard part for me. Is that normal to go and out of
focus? Focus the hard part, yes. It's very normal to go in and out of focus. In fact, this is one of the points that comes up in the Bhagavad Gita, in the chapter called Dhyana Yoga, which is about meditation. And in the Yoga Sutra also, it's described how difficult it is to control the mind. After all, it's very subtle energy, the mind. And it requires training, actually, over a long period of time. It's like if you learn a musical instrument, you know, like a violin, it takes some finesse to play a violin. Not that I know how to play a violin, but I have picked one up now and then. I mean, there's not even frets on a violin. You just have to know where to put your fingers, and you have to. There's a lot of technique involved in that instrument. So, how long does it take to develop some skill in playing the violin? You have to practice over and over and over again, and then you might, after a few months or 6 months or something, get one note and say, "Wow, that sounded good." The rest of the time, it's a lot of frustration. And you have to be really determined. So similarly in meditation or focus or introspection, it requires practice. And that's the exact answer Krishna gives in the Gita, because Arjuna complains and he says, you're talking about yoga, but it seems to me that the mind's impossible to deal with. He says it's like a blowing wind. It's just, how am I going to stop it? And Krishna reassures him through correct practice. And also he says by detachment, which really means to have this perspective that if I continue, and you know, without being attached, then gradually I'll be able to do this. So it's the most frequently asked question that I get anywhere in the world. And when people start to practice japa, which is a very rigorous kind of meditation, it means taking time to chant the mantra with attention. When you develop this kind of home practice, chanting japa, then your spiritual practice really takes off. But in the beginning, it can actually be a little painful. I'll give you another example that's there from one of the great teachers of bhakti. His name is Rupa Goswami. And he wrote a book, which we actually have somewhere, called the Upadeshamrita. And in it, he tries to condense all the basic practices of bhakti into just several verses. So that, you know, you don't have to study all the thousands of pages of writings about bhakti. He uses this little primer that you can read, and then if you follow it, then you'll be successful. So in it, he talks about chanting. And I'll give the Sanskrit for authenticity. He says, Krishneti yasya. Is the verse? Krishneti yasya giritam manasadriyeta diksa. No. Sitapta vidya pitopa tapta rasanasyana rochikam. So this verse, he says that when you have a disease, and he's specifically referring to the disease called jaundice, and in jaundice, what happens is you get you get more bile in your system than you need, and then you turn yellow. And everything tastes bitter. And one of the curatives for jaundice is sugar cane juice, which you can get anywhere in India. They have these grinders by the side of the road, and people, you know, now they're electric a lot of them. They used to like going this by hand. Just put a sugar cane stalk in, and then they, you know, put a little glass underneath and it fills up. And you're supposed to drink that when you have jaundice, but it tastes terrible. But sugar cane juice doesn't taste terrible. I just think it tastes terrible because I'm diseased. So he gives this example, sitapta vidya. When you have the disease called avidya or ignorance, you think that the chanting tastes bitter. But actually, it's first of all, it's a curative, and second of all, it's very sweet. But you don't know, because when you start, the mind's so agitated that it suggests all kinds of other things. It would rather, the mind, frankly, as many of the bhakti scriptures say, the mind would rather drink poison than to drink something nice. That's what it means to be in ignorance. So you have to take the medicine, and over time, it gradually becomes tolerable, and then it becomes sweet. The one thing is you can get free samples, which really helps. So if you're sincere and you try the chanting, it's like, well, I lived in Chicago for a little while, and they used to have, there was a marketing company there, when people would come out with a new candy bar, they'd make the candy bar like about a quarter size of the actual bar that would come out on the market. And they had these young women who would come out with these trays of these candy bars, and they'd give them out on the street. And people would line up for a couple blocks, you know, get a free sample. And then if you came back for another one, they say, oh, you got to go buy it now. And in a similar way, when you practice chanting, then sometimes you get a free sample. It's way beyond what you deserve at your level. But, you know, you taste it, and you go, oh, I saw it for myself. There's something in this. But then, okay, now, you know, work at it a little bit. And you'll get it yourself. One thing, there are many suggestions in the bhakti scriptures for helping you to chant. Just yesterday, at our center down in Silicon Valley, I invited all the devotees to come together early in the morning to sit in a circle. And so I call this a japa circle. And we sit in a circle together, and then we all chant the mantra on our beads. And at intervals, I'd stop and have somebody read a verse or talk about a specific aspect of the chanting to remind everybody of what we're actually doing. Because one of the ways that we get off track is we forget we're chanting. So, just like, have you ever been reading a book? And as you're reading, you go through a whole paragraph, and then you get to the end of the paragraph. You definitely read it, but you have no idea what you just read. So that can happen in chanting also. You can chant for 5 minutes and then realize, I was thinking about my dog, you know. I forgot to cut his toenails, or whatever it is. You know, your mind can just be like totally somewhere else. So one of the practices is really to be aware that you're chanting. And that requires a little effort. So a friend of mine, colleague Chaitanya Charanpuru, who's a prolific speaker and writer, he gives this example. He says, so you sign up for a health club, which everyone does on January 1st. Then they quit, you know, by the 15th. But in any case, say you go to the health club and you're lifting weights or something like that. And after 3 days, you go like, yeah, this is a good idea. I should do this. It's good for me. But, you know, it's a little difficult lifting weights. I will go to the health club. But I'm not actually going to lift the weights. I'll leave the weight on the floor, but I'll just move my arms. So do you get the benefit? No. So it's similar. It's possible to get into the chanting process, and then I become kind of maybe lazy, and I think, like, I don't want to apply myself mentally. It takes a lot of work to apply myself mentally. And therefore, I'll just chant, but I actually won't focus on it. I'll just chant and I'll think of something else. So then it takes a long time to actually get a taste. But if you can find a ways and means to actually focus on your chanting. And one of the great teachers of this science of chanting said, do whatever you have to do. You know, he said, go in a closet, close the door, put a blanket over your head, sit with somebody who's better at it than you, or whatever you have to do, try to make arrangements so that you can get something from it. Because once you discover what's actually in it, then you'll be crazy for it. And then it's much easier. That was a long answer. But thanks for asking. It's a very important question coming from what I'm guessing is a sincere practitioner. Thank you. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask that. Okay? What?
My question is it better to focus on the sounds? Or
is it best to? Better to?
Better to focus on the sounds.
Sounds?
Or the meaning?
Or the meaning?
Or both?
Or both. Well, while you're chanting, it's highly permissible and recommended to just listen to the sound. But I found, and this is also in accordance with the teachings of the great masters, that if you study the meaning of the mantra before, and sometimes even during, you stop at intervals and remember what the mantra means and what it is, then it gives you a lot of impetus to chant. Like in a poem written by one of the great masters I'm talking about, his name is Bhaktivinoda Thakura. And he said, Nagina Kichunahiko or Chota Bhuvanamaji. So in Bengali this means that there's nothing else to be had in all the worlds except for this mantra. So the idea is that actually within the mantra there's unlimited bliss. And everything will come from chanting the mantra. But my mind wants to branch out and try to find anything else in the world. So he's saying to his mind, really, that if you want everything, it's there in one place. And when you hear that, then, you know, you can convince your mind for a while, anyway, to say, okay, whatever you want, it's right here. Stay focused. So studying the meaning is important. And there are a lot of books about it nowadays. A lot of, from the past, many masters have written about it, and even in the present, many advanced, you know, present-day practitioners of bhakti have written books about the meaning of the mantra. And I recommend you read them, because one of the ways to stay focused on the mantra is to really understand, if there's something in this for me, Like sometimes, you know, if you're practicing chanting and you're kind of really sleepy, falling asleep. But if someone came whispered in your ear, you know, like, hey, you just won the lottery, you know, you wouldn't be sleepy probably. So it's not really that we're sleepy, it's just that I'm not interested, I don't have a taste. And so when we do develop a taste, it's kind of like every mantra is like you won the lottery. Like, wow, where has this been all my life? Why have I been looking everywhere else? You know, everything's here in the mantra. And that's pretty amazing, because really we have everything, or I should say, we are everything that we need to be. We don't have to become something else. We're already something that's so miraculous. If we just look at it, even if you just look at your own self and see yourself, this is something that's not commonly done. All the time I do programs around the Bay Area at corporates, and I, you know, go through guided meditations. And in the guided meditation, it's like, it's just to help everyone slow down just for a few minutes and look inside. I was like, wow, I never noticed that before. It's like the closest thing to me, but I'm looking always outside and think it's there, and I got to go a little further to get it. But actually, you're right there. The example I'm sure you've heard many times, but it's about the musk deer. And the beautiful scent of musk is coming from its own navel, but its whole life, poetically saying, you know, so I doubt the musk deer is actually doing this, but it's a nice poetical concept. It's looking everywhere. It's like, where is this coming from? You know, it's like, it's beautiful. It's on the mountain, it's in the tree, it's in wherever. It's like, it's in you. So in the Gita, when Arjuna asks Krishna about what is the symptom of somebody who's fixed in consciousness, the first thing he says, Prajahati yadakaman sarvan partamanavatam atman yiva manatushta stita prajnasta dochite. So a person who's fixed in consciousness, he said, he notices that the mind is a little factory. You can imagine, you know, it's got a little trapdoor in the conveyor belt coming out. So all these little, you know, it's producing all these little things, you know, coming out. But he knows, she knows, by looking there, that these things are just manufactured and they have nothing to do with me. So that's the first thing. Prajahati adakaman, any kinds of material desires and concoctions of the mind, he or she sees that this thing is superfluous to me and is not grabbing onto me anymore. And the second thing is, he says, Atman yegatmana tushta. Tushta means, say tushta, it's nice. Yeah, I actually, it kind of feels when you say it like what it means. It means satisfaction. Tushta. So tushta means satisfaction. So Atman yegatmana tushta. So the person feels satisfied in him or her self. By observing the self, by seeing the self, I'm happy. Like, I have enough, because I am who I am. It's something that never perishes, and it's, it can't be disturbed by anything. So it's actually the most amazing thing that we have is ourself. You know, if you take all the things in San Francisco and you put them on one side of the pan scale, like, the mind can go everywhere. It's like, I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this. Yeah, but I need that first, and I need that second, and then, you know, I need that before this. It's going on and on, concocting all these things that I need. But if you actually see yourself, and you say, like, I'm superfluous to matter, I don't have anything to do with it anyway. And I exist now, I've always existed. What more do you want? So Atman Yivatmana Tushta, when a person actually can glimpse even oneself by introspection and see, like, wow, what I am is beyond what, you know, anything in this world, it's beyond that. And so that person can feel satisfaction and therefore has an inner life. That's what spiritual life means. It's not sectarian. It's actually there for every single living being. Humans have a better opportunity at accessing it, according to the Bhakti scriptures. We're equipped for that. And actually, more than that, we're meant for that. The human apparatus is really meant to discover oneself. That's what it's there for, introspection. Now I forgot whose question I'm answering.
It's a great answer.
Anyway, did we come anywhere close to answering your question? Yes.
Thank you for being here and answering questions.
Thank you for being here and asking questions.
I have two questions.
Please.
My first question is, how important is it to chant at the same time each day? I know some teachers recommend doing it at the same time, and other teachers just say try to do it when you can.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second question.
Could I do one at a time?
Oh, yes, yes.
My mind is like a sieve. So the first question of how important it is to chant at the same time every day. It can be very helpful, but I would say I'd back up just one step and give it a broader category, you know, as far as the discipline goes. And this really applies to any discipline. But since we're talking about bhakti, the word is consistency. So consistency is so powerful. My spiritual master used to go like this. He'd say, drops a day where the stone will lay. Because oftentimes I'm thinking that, that unless I can do everything, I won't do anything. But if you can do one drop, and you can do it consistently, then the effect is there. Now, because it's hard to do something consistently. It's elusive. It's a lot harder than I might think. So if you dedicate yourself and do it consistently, for instance, chanting, it can be very, very helpful. Now, same time, fine, but good luck with that. I mean, life is so convoluted and difficult, right? If you live in an ashram, it's possible. I mean, I lived in an ashram for 13 years. And then, you know, I moved into a house and lived kind of a semi-normal life. And I went to school, I had a business, don't have it anymore, but I'm doing this really full-time. And also, once a year, I go back and I live in an ashram, very tight schedule. I mean, I do from time to time anyway, because I travel and I live in ashrams when I travel a lot. But once a year, I go to India, and I stay at an ashram in a very sacred place, just for very focused spiritual practice for one whole month. And it's, you know, it's down to the minute in the ashram. And it can be very helpful. In one way, it makes your mind peaceful, because basically making decisions all day long about what to do and when to do it can be onerous. For instance, deciding when you're going to eat and stuff, that can be difficult. And I know that from fasting, because I know whenever I fast, there's two fast days every month that I observe very carefully. And I know when I fast, then I have a lot of extra time and far fewer decisions to make during the day. But if you add that up, you know, with all the things you have to do, the bodily things that you have to deal with and all that, if you're in an ashram and you're like down in the minute, this is when you do everything, and everybody's on the same schedule, it can be really powerful. I mean, you could go through a whole month with very focused attention on your practice, and you don't even know it practically, because, you know, you're so regulated. So it is helpful to regulate. And especially chanting early in the morning or doing any spiritual practice is highly recommended in the... I'm notorious for going over time, so I'm just checking. So.
It's not midnight yet.
Don't tempt me. So yeah, taking time in the early morning to chant. And sometimes, if you're on a really busy schedule and you don't live in an ashram, at least do part of your chanting at that time and, you know, practice. I recommend don't put too much pressure on yourself for that, because that can get into that point of, like, unless I can do everything, I won't do anything. So cover the basics as well as you can every day. And yes, time periods. Helpful if you do it at the same time, it can be helpful, but it's not absolutely necessary as long as you finish somehow or other. Second question, and then I'll come back to you.
Oh.
So there are so many mantras that I love, and I know that in Krishna consciousness, they say that the Mahamantra is the most powerful, especially in the country that we're in. But what are your thoughts about chanting other mantras, or do you really stick to the Mahamantra usage?
What's your experience?
I chant all the mantras that I love, but I've never done 16 full rounds of Mahamantra.
Well, when you said that, having done 16 full rounds of Mahamantra, that, you know, I can see in your countenance when you say that, that you're expectant that there might be a deeper experience if you do that. And so I would suggest that you try it. And in fact, maybe do more than that sometime. I mean, pick a day when you can go beyond what you think you can do. It takes organizing the environment and your time for that day, set aside the time. And really, it's really good if you can do it in association with others who are doing it. And just see what it does for you. And taste it for yourself. You know, there's so many things we can do in life, so many mantras to chant, so many places to go and see. But ultimately, and ultimately, we'll all do what we're getting the most taste from. That's just the way we are. You know, it's not like we can stick to any one thing unless we're getting a taste. So it's really, really about what you're tasting. So, you know, the masters of yoga and so many of the bhakti scriptures will say, as you pointed out, you know, everything's in this Mahamantra. That's why it's called the Mahamantra, because everything's subsumed within the mantra there. It's an omnibus mantra. And so if you want to see for yourself, just try it and see what you get out of it. You might be satisfied. And of course, you know, the idea of focusing in one area of practice and then going deeper into it, it can be helpful, because then, I mean, you see actually everything comes from focusing in one place. You drill down, or you can drill a bunch of holes all over the place, and maybe you don't hit water on any of them. But if you really drill deep in one place and you hit water, then hey, what more do you need? Yeah.
Well, to be honest, sometimes I don't have my mala on me, but I sing the Maha Mantra throughout the day, so maybe I have done it 16 rounds.
Well, the key word there is maybe. So now, coming into this idea of consistency and practice, so this is called Samkhya Purvaka. It means numerical strength. So when you're absolutely sure that you did it, that's when you have a little bit of safety from the whimsy of your mind, because my mind does this all the time. You know, it's like any discipline I'm taking in my life, it's like, yeah, you're good, and then I actually measure what I'm doing. Like, say you step on a scale and say, yeah, you know, it's like, oh my god, I just gained 10 pounds. You know, because what do I know unless I measure it? Or even like when I'm practicing an instrument, like this drum, and I use a metronome, and I go like, this metronome must be off, because, you know, like, I'm steady. It's off. And then I think, no, it's not. Actually, the metronome knows what it's doing. You know, I'm the one who's varying in the speed. So it's helpful to count. Of course, what you're doing is perfect. You know, channel day long is good. But just in the matter of counting how much you do, that goes to that whole category I was talking about, the idea of consistency. That's why, you know, you'll see the devotees who carry around the bead bag. Do you have a bead bag? Well, those who have bead bags, I hope I have one, this would be embarrassing. Just kidding. On the bag itself, maybe it's in the car. There, we can borrow hers. See this? The beads are in here, but these are called counter beads. So every time she chants one round, she pulls down a bead like that. Of course, they're all down, so she already finished her rounds, I can tell, for the day. But you finish a round, one round, then you pull the bead. And that way you know when you actually come to 16. It's so easy for the mind to go like, yeah, I'm done. And actually it was, you know, less than that. But so for consistency, it's really helpful to do that. Yeah, you're welcome. We're getting down to the last, so I promised you.
Okay, so you mentioned two fast days of the month. I assume you're talking about Sri Ekadashi.
That's right.
So I lived in a temple 40 years ago and moved. And when I was in the temple, I never liked Ekadashi.
Yeah.
It was an annoyance. No beans or grains, you know, on those days. And when I moved away, when all hell broke loose, the sky's falling, I'm like Chicken Little, and I look up, I look down, I look everywhere to find out what is wrong, the universe hates me, and I don't know why. It's on that day. Ekadashi. So 40 years ago, I started observing Ekadashi. I would do things like, I won't leave out of the city on an Ekadashi. All kinds of things. And I slowly made friends with Ekadashi, but I noticed new moons are nastier than full moons. And there's a whole presence that comes as the day approaches. I notice good omens approaching when the day is approaching. I know, oh, it's going to be a great Ekadashi. And there's bad omens. And, I have the Prabhupada wrote it, or someone interpreted for him. There's a story that comes with the 24 Ekadashis of the year. And every Ekadashi, I read that story before the Ekadashi arrives. It kind of like placates.
You usually have a t-shirt that says, I made friends with Ekadashi.
That's a good idea. So what is yours?
Well, I mean, you know, if you wait around long enough, things come around. Like right now, one of the most popular concepts in the world is intermittent fasting. Have you noticed that? You know, years ago when I followed Ekadashi, you know, it was like, you're fasting? How do you do that? You know, like, why? And now it's like, oh yeah, right. Intermittent fasting. It's the best thing you can do for your health. But it's a part of the spiritual practice. It's actually interesting when you fast, because then, you know, late in the morning, if you're used to eating breakfast or something, your stomach will call up your mind on the telephone and say, hey, what's going on? And they say, hey, we're not eating today. It's like, what do you mean we're not eating? You know, and then you can actually get a little distance from your senses and see, like, hey, there's a whole conversation going on down there. And, you know, it's helpful. It's kind of, it's spiritual life, you perform a little bit of austerity, penance. It can just put you in a different, give you a different perspective that you weren't, that you didn't see, something you didn't see before that can be helpful in your spiritual life. So Ekadashi can be like that. It's kind of also this idea of forced efficiency. You know about this? Like I saw a bumper sticker once that if it wasn't for the last minute, I wouldn't get anything done. But forced efficiency means you have a particular time you have to do something. Like, you know, you're building a rocket, it has to shoot off on a certain date, otherwise you can build it forever. And similarly, you know, twice a month comes in the cycle of the moon is a time when you're still eating. Of course, you can just not eat grains and beans, and that's fine too. You'll notice that one also, because you have to be a little more deliberate in what you eat, and it's a little bit more consideration in that. Okay, there was a last question.
Two questions.
Yes.
I had a question in regard to japa.
Yes.
What you were talking about. Earlier you said that, I loved your metaphor you gave me, go to the gym and kind of be doing this and not really lifting the weights.
Yes.
And in regards to japa. And that is kind of what happens to me when I do japa a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a feeling of like when I sing it, it's such quality time with the mantra. Whereas when I do japa, there's like going to the gym, but I'm not really lifting the weights. And I'll do an entire round or two, and I'm like, it's a little bit calming and peaceful, but I'm not really getting a lot out of it. So my issue is that if you start focusing on counting, because you're saying the quantity is important, so if your focus is on the quantity, somehow you lose touch with the quality. And it's a balancing act, and I have a problem with that. When I sing it, there's no problem, it's all quality. But when I start chanting it, the issue of taking on this legalistic mind of having to go for a certain number, and in turn you end up with a large number but of low quality. And
That's fine. One of my biggest blocks with japa, this where it turns into vain repetition as opposed to quality repetition.
Yeah, that can definitely be an issue. And I liked how you brought up the point of balance. That's very important, too. Again, with any discipline, consistency is important. You know, if you're an athlete, as an example, and let's say you're preparing to run a mile, and then you just like, oh, go around and run whatever, you know, whatever speed I want to run, and as much distance as I want to do, then, you know, your preparation might not be as efficient. And, you know, when you do have a stopwatch or a metronome or something to measure what you're doing when you're practicing, it tends to give you a little honest feedback about how you're actually doing. And so, interestingly, the quality can actually come out of that. Because from discipline, I actually challenge myself. I go a little more on the edge and push myself beyond what I thought I could do sometimes by counting. Because how will I know I'm doing more if I'm not counting? And when I do a little bit more, then the quality comes up. But you're absolutely right. This is a concept you've nailed right on the head, which is vital. And this is identified in that book I told you about. It's called Niyamagraha. So it's an interesting Sanskrit word. It has two meanings in one. So Niyamagraha and Niyamagraha, just pronounced slightly differently with the middle A. So when Niyamagraha means that you actually don't do the practice, you kind of like, and usually by degrees, people give up disciplines. It's not like it just happens all at once. You just like, I'm not doing this anymore. What usually happens is like, oh, I got an emergency. I can't do it right now, and I'll do it later. And then you kind of start getting used to the fact that, well, I didn't do it one day, now I won't do it 2 days. Or by small degrees, you kind of, you know, lose your edge in your practice. So Niyamagraha means to stop doing it altogether. And Niyamagraha means to do it, but you're not really focused on it. You may just be like somebody may totally into the numbers. I just finished 16 rounds, and I did it in an hour and 42 minutes. But like you said, it's like, did you listen? So both things have to be there. And they can both complement one another. It's not that they're mutually exclusive. You have to chant. I mean, you don't have to volunteer. But if you decide you're going to chant, it can help you to measure how much you're doing to overcome the whimsical nature of the mind. But you should still, and some of the things I talked about was prepare yourself so you can actually enter deeply within it and say it with a feeling. Now, if you have both of them working together for you, you've got a really powerful practice. You know, because you're doing both. So it's not like one or the other. It's meet in the middle and do both. And that's called numerical strength. And now we have time for some kirtan. You like kirtan, right? So shall we chant a little bit?
I say both.
Sit down here and play harmonium. And I will, the zapper or something like that. Do you have a mazurka player? Or do you have a really good harmonious that's going to follow me, or should I just play it myself?
Probably better you play it on my own. Okay. Play the drum.
Sure. Okay. Two of these.
Okay, two.
Two. There's one there. One more.
No, there's one there already. One more. Keep them white.
Thank you. I can start with a couple of mantras, offering respects to my guru, and then to the one who brought the Maha Mantra and distributed it, first all over India, and then it managed to make its way to New York and San Francisco, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was a monk who walked barefoot throughout India and went door to door and taught people to chant this mantra. Nao Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Deshatarge. So those two mantras are what are called the pranam mantras from my guru, and they identify him as being a disciple of his guru, because the guru chain comes down from the time of memorial, and one guru follows another. And then it kind of mentions his mission statement. It's Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharya, that he came to teach what this monk I told you about, Chaitanya, taught all over India. He represented his teachings. Gauravani, that's called Gauravani. Nirvishesha Nirvani Paschatadeshita. So he is specifically focused on helping to reveal the esoteric secrets of the spiritual world, in which there's variety, there's dance, there's music, there's what's called raga. Raga means the quality to the music that creates the emotion that comes out of us. And actually, this is one of the main characteristics, according to the Bhakti scriptures, of the spiritual world. There are actually as many living entities as there are that many ragas. There are millions of ragas which bring out from us the deepest kinds of sentiments that we have for our original divine source. It's done through music and singing in the spiritual world. So he came to reveal all that and to bring us above the level of just thinking that the ultimate spiritual realization is zero. Because if you look at a number line, you'll find there's negative numbers, and that's like material life. I'm working hard, but I'm getting more and more in debt. And then I might conclude that I come up to zero, but zero, zero. But bhakti means the positive numbers on the number line. You're dancing, moving, singing, everything, but it's coming from joy. It's not coming from debt or exploitation. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. And that's the mantra to Shri Chaitanya, who taught the Maha Mantra over 500 years ago, and who gave teachings to his disciples that all the people who follow Bhakti Yoga in this line are attentive to. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare
Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama
Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama
Hare Hare.
Hare
Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare
here on Tuesday nights. There is a talk on the Bhagavad Gita, and Thursday nights there's kirtan, and this is the Sunday mantra lounge program. And there's also yoga going on Mondays and Wednesdays, and on Fridays there is special events going on. So if you haven't yet put your name, sign up for the newsletter. You can also look at the books and leave your contribution. There's a bathroom here, there's water. Feel free to ask any questions you like. We're here to serve you and have you as part of the Bhakti Center West community. Thank you all for coming, and wish you a fantastic week.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, hey, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman.